Television. On the horizon. Apart from lots of interviews here and there, my first intensive exposure to television cameras was in 1986, when I was approached by Jeremy Taylor, one of the resident producer-directors of the BBC's flagship, as it was then justly called, Horizon series of science documentaries. Americans at the time frequently knew Horizon programmes as Nova, because WGBH in Boston put out a parallel series of similarly good documentaries, many of which were rebranded, sometimes represented, Horizons, occasionally even with an American voiceover. I never verified the rumour that the reason for the latter change was a fear that Americans can't understand, or at least don't enjoy listening to, British English. It seems unlikely, in view of the popularity of dramas such as Upstairs, Downstairs, or the anachronism-prone Downton Abbey. On the other hand, I was astounded to be told by a scandalised American friend, Todd Stiefel, that the BBC's Life, perhaps the most ambitious wildlife documentary series ever screened, and narrated by none other than David Attenborough himself, was doctored for an American audience, with Attenborough's narration replaced by the voice of Oprah Winfrey. I'm happy to say that the verdict of American Amazon reviewers who compared the two versions has been overwhelmingly in favour of the genuine article. I can't help wondering why Oprah Winfrey agreed to do it. Was she not afraid of the inevitable comparisons with the peerless Sir David? I was certainly afraid when Jeremy Taylor approached me because of the formidable reputation of Horizon Nova and because I doubted whether I would be good enough to do television. I had been approached 10 years earlier by another Horizon producer, Peter Jones, to present a documentary on the selfish gene. I declined through sheer nerves and recommended John Maynard Smith instead. He did an excellent job. I should say that, although my memory is that I turned down the selfish gene documentary through nerves, Jeremy Taylor, who kindly read this chapter for me in draft, has a different recollection based on his friendship with Peter Jones. The story I recollect is that Horizon, not necessarily Peter, thought you too youthful in appearance to credibly present your own ideas, rather like the choir boy delivering the sermon. Indeed, when I raised the idea a decade later of approaching you to present Nice Guys, the then Horizon editor, Robin Brightwell, was dead against the idea, again citing the fact that you looked too young, and would viewers have confidence in you? I insisted, and Brightwell told me, "Well, I won't forbid it, but on your own head be it." So if you felt a bit jittery presenting it, imagine the feelings I was concealing, I hope, from you. Of course, Nice Guys, the documentary that Jeremy and I went on to make, went down a storm with Horizon, BBC Two and the controllers, and attitudes to the idea of the blind watchmaker, Jeremy's next proposal for a documentary with me, changed dramatically. When Jeremy approached me to do Nice Guys Finished First, I was, and presumably looked, 10 years older and a bit more confident, but I was still jittery about it. What swung me over was his enthusiasm for the topic he proposed. He had read a book called The Evolution of Cooperation by the American social scientist Robert Axelrod, and thought the game-theoretic approach to cooperation would form the basis of a great horizon. I knew Axelrod's work well because, long before he published his book, as I wrote in my foreword to the second edition, I received out of the blue a typescript from an American political scientist whom I didn't know, Robert Axelrod. It announced a computer tournament to play the game of Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma and invited me to compete. To be more precise, and the distinction is an important one for the very reason that computer programs don't have conscious foresight, it invited me to submit a computer program that would do the competing. I'm afraid I didn't get around to sending in an entry, but I was hugely intrigued by the idea, and I did make one valuable, if rather passive, contribution to the enterprise at that stage. Axelrod was a professor of political science, and in my partisan way, I felt that he needed to collaborate with an evolutionary biologist. I wrote him an introduction to W.D. Hamilton, probably the most distinguished Darwinian of our generation. Axelrod immediately contacted Hamilton, and they collaborated. Hamilton was actually a professor in the same institution as Axelrod, the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, but they didn't know each other until I introduced them. Their collaboration resulted in a prize-winning paper called The Evolution of Cooperation, later incorporated as a chapter of Axelrod's book of the same title. so I felt a tiny bit possessive about my backseat part in the book's genesis. In any case, I loved it. I quote again from the foreword that I wrote for its second edition. I read it as soon as it appeared with mounting excitement, and took to recommending it with evangelical zeal to almost everyone I met. Every one of the undergraduates I tutored in the years following its publication was required to write an essay on Axelrod's book, and it was one of the essays they most enjoyed writing. Understandably, then, when I received the overture from Jeremy Taylor and heard how he shared my enthusiasm for Axelrod's book, I couldn't resist. We met, and, picking up on that enthusiasm, I immediately liked him. I found him faintly reminiscent of my new college friend, the intelligible philosopher Jonathan Glover. Jeremy soothed my fears about television, saying that we would start slowly and see how it went. He preferred not to script my pieces to camera, with the reservation that, if it should prove necessary, we'd change to a more scripted format. Fortunately, that didn't happen. Instead, the way it eventually worked was that he and I would rather intensively talk over each piece immediately before I delivered it. Then, after each one was safely in the can, we'd discuss the next piece until I had that one clear in my mind, then record that, and so on. The film ended up being called Nice Guys Finish First, and I'll call it that here, although we didn't hit on the name till it was nearly finished. It's a play on Nice Guys Finish Last, an aphorism which, despite the frisson of sexual innuendo, is said to have originated in the world of baseball. The first scene we shot was on Port Meadow, the great flood meadow between Oxford and the Isis River, as this stretch of the Thames is called. Port Meadow has been unploughed common land since Doomsday Book, granted as grazing to the freemen of the city of Oxford and the commoners of Wolvercote. The Wolvercote house I used to live in with my first wife, Marion, overlooked its spreading acres, and it was easy to fantasise it into a kind of wetter English version of the Serengeti Plain, with wandering herds not of wildebeest and zebra, but of cattle and horses. The relevance of common land to Nice Guys Finish First was the tragedy of the commons, the topic and title of a famous paper by the American ecologist Garrett Hardin. Common land is ruined by overgrazing. The system of the commons works as long as everybody exercises restraint. If an individual commoner is greedy and puts too many cattle on the land, all suffer. But the selfish individual suffers no more than anybody else, and he gains disproportionate benefits because he has more cattle. There is, therefore, an incentive for everybody to behave selfishly, and that is the tragedy of the commons. A more familiar example, a group of 10 people go to a restaurant and agree in advance to share the bill, each one paying a tenth. One person orders a much more expensive dish than anybody else. He knows he'll be paying only 10% of the increased cost on the bill, but he'll receive 100% of the benefit of the more expensive dish. So there is little incentive for each individual to exercise restraint in ordering, and the bill escalates beyond the likely total if everybody bought their own. Jeremy wanted me to do a piece to camera about the tragedy of the commons, and this being television, there had to be a visual illustration in the background. Port Meadow, ancient medieval common land literally on my own doorstep, was perfect. Here, opportunity for gentle humour presented itself, and Jeremy, as a good television producer will, seized it. It is the responsibility of the holder of the ancient office of Sheriff of the City of Oxford to attend an annual round-up of all the animals, the exact date of the round-up being kept secret. At least it's supposed to be kept secret. Jeremy apparently got wind of it, or maybe he didn't, but just struck lucky and took serendipitous advantage. Owners of animals grazed illegally on Port Meadow used to be fined, the object being to reduce the tragedy of the commons. But more recently, the annual round-up has become a toothless ritual in which the animals are temporarily corralled, but no attempt is made to establish ownership or responsibility. This would theoretically allow the tragedy to run its course. We filmed scenes of the roundup interposed with my pieces to camera explaining the principle of the tragedy. As I watched Jeremy directing his camera crew, I couldn't help noticing that part of his intention seemed to be comedic. He was sending up the sheriff's men and their pet tradition. I was a little concerned and I asked him about it. He grinned and said they wouldn't notice, and even if they did, they wouldn't mind. People love being on television for any reason. I learned a lesson about the subtle wit that characterises the best documentary directors, a trait that I was to see several more times during my years of occasional television presenting. To be truly witty, it mustn't be laboured, and this was another lesson I learned from Jeremy. Jeremy was even capable of laughing at the conventions and clichés of his own medium of television while using them himself. He had me explaining the restaurant example while driving a car and talking to a non-existent passenger by my side. Simon Rakes, who directed a later documentary that I did for Channel 4, Break the Science Barrier, more on that to come, made explicit the joke against this particular cliché by cutting from me addressing my passenger to a shot of the car from outside, which clearly showed that there was no passenger to address, not even the cameraman, of course. When I protested about this, Simon laughed and said nobody would notice. It had become part of the grammar of television, an accepted convention. A similarly accepted convention of television documentaries is the walking towards the camera shot, in which the presenter is filmed talking to a non-existent person who must unrealistically be presumed to be walking backwards in retreat. The cameraman really is walking backwards, at some hazard to himself and passers-by, were it not for solicitous steering by the sound man hanging onto his shoulder. I have always drawn the line at this televisual cliché. My refusal to do it has been accepted, sometimes reluctantly, by every director I've worked with. Yet another convention of television, the speeded-up cloud shot, often deployed to indicate passage of time, can actually be rather beautiful, so I have no objections to it. Playing tricks with time, both speeding things up and slowing them down, is something David Attenborough's marvellous documentaries frequently exploit, to great effect, although I wish he would tell us explicitly that he's doing it, at least on those occasions when it isn't obvious. His wonderfully entertaining autobiography, Life on Air, has a fascinating discussion of the earliest days of television documentaries, where he and his colleagues had to invent the conventions, the grammar of documentary television, from scratch. When to do a fade, when an abrupt cut, when to use a voiceover, when to show the speaker's face, and so on. After Nice Guys Finish First was broadcast, I enjoyed a brief honeymoon period when my name was associated with niceness instead of selfishness, as is commonly the case because so many people read my first book by title only. Three prominent corporations approached me. The chairman of Marks & Spencer, Lord Seif, made contact through his daughter, Daniela, who happened to be a pupil of mine at New College, inviting me to lunch in the company boardroom in London. Daniela and I were the only guests, and her father explained to us, plausibly enough, that Marks & Spencer was a very nice company which treated its employees well. I saw no reason to doubt him, but I'm not sure he really got the point of the Nice Guys Finish First documentary. Maybe Daniela explained it to him afterwards. Then, rather less plausibly, a young woman from the publicity department of the Mars Corporation took me to lunch in order to explain to me that her company sold chocolate bars not to make money, but in order to sweeten people's lives. She herself was sweet, and I enjoyed having lunch with her, but I found her corporate message as cloying as her chocolate. Finally, a British senior executive of IBM Europe, who really did understand the message of our documentary, flew me to the company's Brussels headquarters to supervise a training game for middle management executives. The purpose was to help them bond and thereby improve the atmosphere of the workplace. These dynamic young suits were divided into three teams, the Reds, the Blues and the Greens, in order to play a modified version of Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma. I won't spell out the details of this game theory classic here. The details are all in Axelrod's book and in the second edition of The Selfish Gene. Each team was shut up in a separate room, and they communicated their moves by runner. Good cooperative rapport between all three teams was built up and maintained during the long afternoon, exactly as Axelrod would have predicted. But alas, the theory also predicts that if a game of Iterated Prisoner's Dilemma is known to be going to end at a fixed time, the temptation to defect rises. This is because the final round, if it is known to be the final round, is equivalent to a one-off prisoner's dilemma, where the rational strategy is to defect. And if you know that your rational opponent is likely to defect on the last round, a preemptive strike in the last but one becomes rational, and so on back. Axelrod coined the phrase the shadow of the future, meaning the expected time to the end of the game. The shorter the shadow, the higher the temptation to defect. And unfortunately, in the case of the IBM game, it was known that it was going to end at 4 p.m. We should have anticipated the resulting catastrophe and, instead of announcing the termination time in advance, blown a whistle at a random, unpredictable moment. As things were, it was not at all surprising with hindsight that just before the witching hour of tea time, the Reds massively defected against the Blues, betraying a long-standing trust that had been painstakingly built up throughout the afternoon. Far from helping these executives to bond, our game, even though it was played for tokens rather than real money, caused so much ill feeling between the Blues and the Reds that they had to have counselling before they could work together again on the serious business of running IBM. It seems quite funny now, but I didn't feel good about it on the journey home. Nice Guys Finish First was followed, not long after, by another Horizon documentary, again directed by Jeremy Taylor. This time the title came first, The Blind Watchmaker. Like the book after which it was named, which had just been published, the documentary was a response to creationism, and that was a sufficient reason to do much of the filming in Texas. Jeremy and I flew to Dallas, hired a car, and drove to the small and sleepy town of Glen Rose. The nearby Paluxy River flows shallowly over sensuously smooth flat limestone in which are elegantly preserved dinosaur footprints. Well, some of them are elegantly preserved, showing the characteristic three toes of dinosaurs. Others, however, are sufficiently ill-formed to be seen, by the eye of faith, and I do mean faith, as human footprints. In the 1930s, the Paluxy became a mecca for creationists eager to believe that the world was young and humans walked with dinosaurs, the behemoth mentioned in the Book of Job. A market in fake dinosaur footprints, together with giant human ones, made of cement, was set up in Glen Rose, and the evidence became part of the stock-in-trade of creationist law and literature. Jeremy hired a local Texan film crew, and we tramped through the wilderness from Glen Rose to the Paluxy River, where we spent a lovely day wading and paddling in the warm, shallow water with its sympathetically smooth limestone bottom. We were accompanied by Ronnie Hastings, a local science teacher, and Glenn Cuban, the two men who had done the most to uncover the real truth about the Paluxy River man tracks. They are really dinosaur spores, but from heels, so the three toes don't show. Looking at the film again today to remind myself while writing this, I'm a little embarrassed by the brevity of my shorts, and they have indeed been the subject of some ribaldry on the internet. Short shorts are not fashionable today, but I must say I can't help finding Bermudas rather ridiculously long, even ungainly. Besides, they would have got wet as I waded in the Paluxy. My friend Jeremy Cherfus, himself experienced in television, told me a shorts story about another documentary presenter, the distinguished South African anthropologist Glyn Isaac. He was being filmed as he crouched down to pick up a fossil, which he then turned over to show to the camera. His shorts were very short, and he didn't realise that his penis was visible. The director scrupulously called, "Cut!" But, in Cherfus's words, the cameraman, being a great cameraman, just kept on rolling. No such embarrassment happened to me, but I have to admit that very short shorts wouldn't be wardrobe's natural choice, to quote Lala, for reciting Shakespeare, as I had to do, the passage where Hamlet notes the ease with which the human eyes fooled by superficial resemblances, in his case of clouds to animals, in my case of dinosaur heel prints to human footprints. "Methinks it is like a weasel," is one of the sentences uttered by Hamlet in his cloud comparisons, and I had used it in The Blind Watchmaker, the book, that is, to illustrate the difference between cumulative selection and one-off selection. An infinite number of monkeys bashing away randomly at typewriters for an infinite amount of time will write the complete works of Shakespeare, together with an infinite quantity of other poetry and prose in an infinite number of languages. But this is no more than an illustration of the ungraspability of the very idea of infinity. Even the short sentence, "Methinks it is like a weasel," would take a regiment of monkeys more billions of years than anyone can contemplate. If you programmed a computer to simulate a monkey typing character strings of the right length at random, and even if it took only 1 second to type each string of 28 letters, you would have to wait about a billion, billion, billion times as long as the world has so far existed to achieve any likelihood of hitting "Methinks it is like a weasel." I jokingly wrote in The Blind Watchmaker that I didn't know any monkeys, but fortunately my 11-month-old daughter Juliet was an excellent randomising device, and she proved only too eager to step into the role of monkey typist. Eager was an understatement. She would visit me in my rooftop aerie overlooking the Oxford Canal and pound away at the keyboard with her little fists, loyally trying to help me meet the deadline for finishing my book. After listing some of the random strings she typed, I went on, "She has other important calls on her time, so I was obliged to program the computer to simulate a randomly typing baby or monkey." Anybody familiar with the medium of television will not be surprised to learn that Jeremy wanted to recreate the scene. Juliet's mother, Eve, brought Juliet to my room in New College, where we were filming. Perhaps it was the intimidating presence of cameras and cameramen, lights and huge silvered umbrellas, and a director shouting, "Turn over and cut!" But poor Juliet, even when sitting on her mother's knee, was overcome with stage fright and refused to show her virtuosity at the keyboard. So in the end, the film went straight to the computer, which simultaneously compared the simulated monkey to a Darwin algorithm, which used cumulative selection. Partially successful mutant strings were selectively allowed to reproduce through successive generations, and the whole process of breeding the sentence, "Methinks it is like a weasel," took only a minute or so. The weasel program was, of course, a simulation of Darwinian evolution only in a very limited sense. It was designed only to illustrate the power of cumulative selection as opposed to single-generation randomization and selection. Moreover, it homed in on a distant target, the preordained phrase, "Methinks it is like a weasel," which is very different from how evolution works in real life. In real life, that which survives, survives. There is no distant target, tempting as it may be to imagine one with hindsight. This was why I went on to write the much more interesting and lifelike series of biomorph programs, which I'll discuss later, and which also played a prominent part in the film. A later scene in the documentary took us to Berlin. The purpose was to film a German engineer, Ingo Reckenberg, who was pioneering Darwinian selection as a method of perfecting the design of windmills and diesel engines. But we took the opportunity to visit the Berlin Wall and watch the East German guards waiting to shoot anybody attempting to escape the Orwellian oppression of the Stasi. At this bleak and depressing spectacle, Jeremy's habitual cheerfulness deserted him, and I have never forgotten his heart cry of despair, not aimed at anyone in particular, but roared up anonymously into the rain-grey sky. I'm glad I did those two BBC Horizon films, but looking at them again, in order to write this chapter, I'm struck, even a tiny bit embarrassed, by a nervous hesitancy in my delivery of pieces to camera. Possibly one reason was an awareness that every mistake I made was costly. In those days, our filming was done on 16mm film, which was expensive and couldn't be reused. Today's digital recording media have zero cost. Mistakes cost only the extra time needed for another take. Although Jeremy was very nice about it and never mentioned the cost of film and his limited budget from the BBC, every time I made a fluff in those Horizon films, I felt the need to apologise. Jeremy actually denies the halting lack of confidence to which I've just confessed and suspects that I'm being oversensitive to my own shortcomings. In any case, perhaps because of the drop in the monetary cost of mistakes due to the shift to digital media, or perhaps because I was 10 years older, I don't seem to notice the same hesitancy when I look today at Break the Science Barrier, a documentary for Channel 4 that I presented in 1996. Break the Science Barrier. Channel 4 doesn't have its own internal production staff or facilities. Instead, and the BBC increasingly follows this model, they commission work from any of a large number of independent production companies that have sprung up in London and all around the country. So the initial approach for Break the Science Barrier came to me not from Channel 4, but from John Gow Productions Limited. It didn't take me long to discover that John Gow was one of the most respected figures in British television, a BBC veteran who had left to found his own independent company, widely revered for his experience in the world of television and his success in winning commissions and awards. I had little hesitation in agreeing to my name going forward in his bid to Channel 4. The bid was successful, and John hired a freelance director, Simon Rakes, to direct the film, which John himself would produce. I got on well with both Simon and John, and I ended up very pleased with the film, an impression confirmed when I watched it again recently. Break the Science Barrier combined in roughly equal measure a paean to the scientific method and the wonders it reveals, and a lament for the neglect of science in our world. To illustrate the latter, we feature the story of Kevin Callan, a British lorry driver who was sentenced to life imprisonment for murder and subsequently released for reasons that we went on to tell. The jury were convinced by expert testimony from doctors ignorant of the science of head injury that Kevin had shaken his 4-year-old stepchild Mandy to death. The point we were making was that ignorance of science on the part of not just the judge and the prosecution, but also Kevin's own defence team, had led to an unjust conviction. When he had ventured to ask his own lawyer what experts they were going to call in his defence, the lawyer told him to shut up and called no witnesses. The reason was that the doctors the defence had thought to call agreed with the prosecution experts. Kevin was on his own, the sole witness in his own defence, and he was sent down for life. He was on his own, but indomitable. Prison rules allowed him to order books, and he systematically set about teaching himself the recondite subject of neuropathology. Long after his release in his small house on the Welsh coast, he showed our television camera the massive files of notes on the subject that he had accumulated while in prison. These notes seemed to me as full and as detailed as those of any first-class university student swatting for a final examination, with the difference that Kevin was faced with a rather more serious interpretation of final. Can you imagine how soul-destroying it would be to contemplate a lifetime in prison stretching ahead of you, knowing you were innocent? Eventually, he found a book by a New Zealand neuropathologist, Professor Philip Wrightson, which described symptoms identical to poor Mandy's. Kevin wrote to Wrightson and sent him all the details from the court records. Wrightson studied them exhaustively and became convinced that Mandy's injuries could not possibly have been caused by shaking. They were caused by a fall, which was what Kevin had said all along. The case was reopened on the strength of Wrightson's new testimony, and Kevin was released without a stain on his character. But, as my spoken commentary said, an innocent man had spent 4 years in jail. If this disturbing history had taken place in an execution-happy jurisdiction, such as Texas, Kevin would presumably be dead. And even in Britain, but for his astonishing tenacity and the integrity of a good doctor from New Zealand, he would still be languishing in jail and probably hideously ill-treated by the other inmates. Our documentary included a damning indictment by one of Britain's most eminent barristers, Michael Mansfield, QC, of the scientific ignorance of the judge and all the lawyers involved. I was moved by Kevin's story, and I came away with a fierce respect for this relatively uneducated truck driver who had, by sheer force of will and intelligence, educated himself in the relevant science and also in the scientific method of thinking. His lawyers were far better educated than this heroic young man, but they were educated in the wrong subjects, and they let him down. We also, in the film, deplored the widespread public descent into superstition and gullibility, a theme to which I would return in Unweaving the Rainbow and in a later documentary for Channel 4, Enemies of Reason. For Breaking the Science Barrier, we filmed Ian Rowland, a professional conjurer who performed tricks of the kind alleged by spoon-bending mountebanks to be paranormal or supernatural, but who was himself at pains to emphasise that he was doing nothing but tricks. If somebody else does it supernaturally, he's doing it the hard way. In America, the same role of honest, fraud-busting magician has long been filled by that veteran sceptic, James the Amazing Randi. Other spectacular illusionists who go out of their way to promote scientific reason and debunk the charlatans are Penn and Teller and Jamie Ian Swiss, all of whom I am proud to call my friends. I have never performed a conjuring trick in my life, but, perhaps and is the better conjunction, I am fascinated by what the best stage magicians can do. It might almost be said to have philosophical implications. When I watch a world-class conjurer like Jamie Ian Swiss in America or Derren Brown in Britain, my sense of the miraculous is so strong that it takes a strenuous effort of will to persuade myself that there really is a rational explanation. Contrary to all apparent evidence, what I have seen isn't a miracle. turning water into wine or walking on water would seem child's play compared to what these remarkable performers can do. I have to keep telling myself it really is only a trick, even though all my instincts are screaming miracle, supernatural, paranormal. Honest spellbreakers like James Randi or Ian Rowland or Jamie Ian Swiss or Derren Brown or Penn and Teller don't need to come clean about exactly how they do it. They cannot. It would be breaking their professional code to do so. It is enough that they reassure us that it really is a trick. A shameful confession. I was no longer a child when I saw on television the following paranormal performance by an alleged strongman. He had a fishing hook inserted in the skin of his back, and he appeared to be towing with a fishing line a large, heavy railway truck. The skin of his naked back was pulled dramatically outwards, and he did lots of straining and groaning acting. Slowly but surely, the truck moved. My confession, and I overcome my shame to tell it as an illustration of how we are all vulnerable, is that I did not immediately dismiss it as a trick because the laws of physics simply cannot be violated in that way. Rather, my reaction was, well, what a remarkable man. There are more things in heaven than earth, Horatio. There, got that confession out of the way, and I feel a complete and utter fool. But I know the gullible me of that time is lamentably far from alone. The honesty of conjurers like Penn and Teller, James Randi and others is not in their commercial interests, by the way. Quite the contrary. The fakes and fraudsters who perform the same tricks, or more usually inferior tricks, but claim on television that they are supernatural and then write best-selling books about their powers, must laugh all the way to the bank, or all the way to the oil or mining companies whose foolish executives pay them handsomely to divine by psychic powers where to drill for oil or precious minerals. The philosophical interest goes further. Scientists of a rationalist bent are often challenged to say what might in principle cause them to change their minds and come to regard naturalism as falsified. What would it take to convince you of something supernatural? I used to pay lip service to the promise that I would become a supernaturalist overnight the moment somebody showed me some convincing evidence. I presumed it obvious that such evidence would be easy for a god, say, to furnish. But now, stimulated by thoughtful discussion by Steve Zara, one of the regular contributors to my website, richarddawkins.net, I'm less sure. What would convincing evidence for supernaturalism look like? What could it possibly look like? A close magic trick by Jamie Ian Swiss appears to be as supernatural as almost any miracle I can imagine, and in this case I'm assured by the honest conjurer that it really is only a trick, an illusion. If Jesus appeared to me in clouds of glory, or I saw the stars move into a new constellation, spelling out the names of Zeus and the entire Olympian pantheon, why would I reject the hypothesis that I was dreaming, or hallucinating, or the victim of a cunning illusion, perhaps manufactured by extraterrestrial physicists or an alien David Copperfield-style conjurer, rather than succumb to the cop-out theory that the laws of nature had been overthrown by a supernatural event? Superhuman, yes, why not? I'd be surprised if the vast universe was not home to superhuman intelligences. But supernatural? What could supernatural even mean, other than falling outside our present, temporally imperfect understanding of science? Arthur C. Clarke, the famously prophetic science fiction writer, made a related point in his Third Law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. If we could somehow fly back to the Middle Ages in a Boeing 747 and invite people aboard to show them a laptop computer, a colour television, or a mobile telephone, even their greatest intellects would conclude that all four devices were supernatural and we were gods. Again, what could supernatural ever mean, other than beyond our present understanding? Clever tricks by expert conjurers are beyond my present understanding and probably yours too. We are tempted to call them supernatural, but we resist the temptation because we know, the conjurers themselves assure us, they are not. As David Hume advised us, we should exercise the same scepticism over all alleged miracles, because the alternative to the miracle hypothesis, even though implausible, is nevertheless more plausible than the miracle. The other half of Break the Science Barrier's message promoting the wonder of science, we covered by, among other things, filming Professor Jocelyn Bell Burnell, the discoverer of pulsars, in the evocative location of the giant radio telescope at Jodrell Bank, near Manchester. What a moving spectacle that is, the giant cyclopean parabola staring out through deep space into deep time. We also interviewed David Attenborough and, another coup, Douglas Adams. The speech about novels and science books I quoted in the introductory chapter came from this interview with Douglas, which ended with my asking him this: what is it about science that really gets your blood running? And here is what he said, impromptu and with his infectious enthusiasm somehow enhanced rather than lessened by the twinkle in the eye that endears us to his perennial readiness to laugh at himself. The world is a thing of utter inordinate complexity and richness and strangeness that is absolutely awesome. I mean the idea that such complexity can arise not only out of such simplicity, but probably absolutely out of nothing, is the most fabulous, extraordinary idea. And once you get some kind of inkling of how that might have happened, it's just wonderful. And the opportunity to spend 70 or 80 years of your life in such a universe is time well spent as far as I'm concerned. Alas, he and we only got 49. This is as good a moment as any to mention my friendship with Douglas and how I came to know him. The first of his books that I read was not The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. It is certainly the only book I've ever read from cover to cover, and then immediately turned back to page one and read again from cover to cover. I did that because, the first time through, it took me a while to twig all the Coleridge references, and I wanted to read it again, this time on the alert for them. It's also the only book that has prompted me to write a fan letter to its author. It was an early email, sent at a time when emails were rare. The Apple Computer Company had its own internal email network called AppleLink. You could only send emails to other members of the AppleLink circle, and in the late 1980s, there were only a few hundred of us in the whole world. Douglas and I were among them through the good offices of Alan Kay. Alan had earlier been at Xerox Park, where he was one of the founding geniuses of the WIMP interface, Windows, Icons, Menus, or Mouse, Pointer, which Apple and later Microsoft were to adopt. In the great diaspora from the computational Athens that was Xerox Park, Alan moved to Apple with the honorific title of Apple Fellow, founding his own unit for developing educational software and adopting a very fortunate Los Angeles junior school as his testbed. Alan was a fan of both Douglas's and my books, and both of us were elected as honorary advisors to his educational unit. One of the perks was early membership in AppleLink, and given that there were so few of us on the network, it was easy for me to look Douglas's name up and email my fan letter to him. He replied promptly, saying that he was a fan of my books too, and inviting me to visit him the next time I was in London. I arrived at his tall Islington house and rang the bell. Douglas opened the door already laughing. I immediately had the sense that he was laughing not at me but at himself, or perhaps more precisely at my anticipated reaction. He must have seen it many times before, to his spectacular height. When he was a boy, school expeditions were told to meet not under the clock but under Adams. Or perhaps he was just laughing ironically at some absurdity of life which he presumed I would find equally amusing. I went in with him, and he showed me round his house, bristling with guitars, MIDI music equipment, futuristically giant loudspeakers, and, as it seemed, dozens of retired Macintosh computers, fallen afoul of Moore's Law and languishing in the shade of their state-of-the-art successors. It became obvious that we did indeed laugh at exactly the same things and revelled in companionable recognition of the same comic absurdities. He would have guessed, for instance, that I must laugh delightedly at this. The fact that we live at the bottom of a deep gravity well, on the surface of a gas-covered planet going round a nuclear fireball 90 million miles away, and think this to be normal, is obviously some indication of how skewed our perspective tends to be. And at the infinite improbability drive, and at the electric monk, the labour-saving device that you buy to do your believing for you, the advanced version of which was capable of believing things they wouldn't believe in Salt Lake City. And at the appetizingly suicidal and morally sophisticated dish of the day in the restaurant at the end of the universe, introduced in the chapter on my Christmas lectures. I've already explained how I met my wife at Douglas's 40th birthday party. But 42 is a more significant number in the Adams canon, and he celebrated his 42nd birthday in characteristic style, a massive dinner for hundreds of guests. Although it was a sit-down dinner, it almost failed to consummate that promise because of its remarkable seating plan. Shoving a card on each placemat bearing the guest's name was far too simple for Douglas. Douglas's place cards had two names, referring not to the person sitting there, but to the neighbours on either side. The person on your left is Richard Dawkins. Ask him to say grace. The person on your right is Ed Victor. Turn to him and say, in an incredulous tone, 15? Douglas's agent, Ed Victor, was then the only literary agent in London who took a commission as high as 15%. Sorting out this placement was a feat of such gratuitous complexity that it occupied Douglas, abetted, I suspect, by more than one of his fleet of Mac computers, most of the evening, and we didn't finally sit down to dinner until nearly midnight. How I miss him, with his world-class sense of humour and, as has been said, world-class imagination. Break the Science Barrier ended with a quintessentially Oxford scene, Lala reclining in a punt while I poled her romantically up the Charwell, plus the cameraman playing Gooseberry, of course, but the audience is supposed not to work that out. With my voiceover extolling the beauty of scientific reality, as we both appreciated it. Seven Wonders. In the mid-90s, the BBC producer Christopher Sykes conceived the idea of a television series in which scientists were asked to name their own personal list of seven wonders of the world and talk impromptu about each one. Christopher illustrated their choices, presumably with footage from the BBC's vast library. My seven wonders were the spider's web, the bat's ear, the embryo, digital codes, the parabolic reflector, the pianist's fingers, and Sir David Attenborough, which prompted a delightfully funny handwritten letter from the great man. This half hour of concentrated television was one of the few things I've done which apparently earned me no enemies and lots of friends. Does that make it a good programme? It doesn't make it a bad one, notwithstanding Winston Churchill's, "You made enemies? Good, it means you were doing something right." I have never gone out of my way to seek enemies, but they sometimes seem to loom up out of the darkness on the straight road ahead. The Seven Wonders format threw up some wonderful candidates. Steven Pinker, for example, chose the bicycle, combinatorial systems, the language instinct, the camera, the eye, stereo vision, and the mystery of consciousness. I don't think anyone chose the taxi driver's hippocampus, but perhaps they should have. London's black cab drivers have to pass an exam testing their knowledge, it's even called the knowledge, of every last little street and alleyway in one of the world's great cities, and it's been shown that in the driver's brain, the part called the hippocampus is enlarged. There's a certain sadness in the thought that the knowledge may soon be made redundant by GPS navigation. Yet GPS systems have a way to go before they can rival the knowledge of backstreet shortcuts and how the best ones change with traffic conditions. Other scientists in the series included my personal hero John Maynard Smith, Stephen Jay Gould, Danny Hillis, inventor of the parallel processing supercomputer, James Lovelock, the Gaia guru, and Miriam Rothschild. This remarkable old lady's seven wonders were ear mites, the monarch butterfly, the jump of the flea, dawn on the Jungfrau, the bizarrely complex life cycle of a parasitic worm, carotenoid pigments, such as the ones by which we see, and Jerusalem. Her delight in them was infectious, the enthusiasm of a child bubbling over in an 87-year-old, and her show was a type specimen exemplar of Christopher Sykes's concept. Dame Miriam. I didn't know Miriam well, but so remarkable a character demands a digression. She used to invite Lala and me to her annual dragonfly party, so called because guests were encouraged to view the dragonfly conservation measures around her lake, at her country house at Ashton, near Oundle, where I had earlier been at boarding school. Her garden was something to behold. There is a coffee table book, The New Englishwoman's Garden, in which each double-page spread is devoted to the garden of some high-born or well-connected lady. The pages glow with immaculate lawns shaded by immemorial cedars, tastefully understated flowerbeds, herbaceous borders, shady arbours, and ancient brooding yew alleys. All is as expected until you turn the page to the garden of the Honourable Miriam Rothschild. They could have left off the Honourable and replaced it with FRS, but that would have been out of the book's character. This little barb will make sense to non-British readers only if I explain that in Britain, the Honourable is a title given to progeny of lords, and FRS, Fellow of the Royal Society, is a genuine honour conferred on scientists. Her garden was stylishly her own. The plants were all such as the other ladies would have called weeds. They consisted entirely of wild English meadow flowers and unmown grasses. Waves of flower-decked long grass buffeted the walls of the house and crashed through the windows into the interior window boxes, which therefore looked like an indoor continuation of the garden. The large house itself was so smothered in creepers you almost needed a machete to find it, like a fairy-tale castle in an enchanted forest. Under faded family photographs, including one of the bowler-hatted and full-bearded second Lord Rothschild driving through London in his coach pulled by four zebras, were the cases containing the celebrated Rothschild insect collections. The luncheons themselves were sumptuous buffets. At one of these annual dragonfly bashes, she beckoned me over to her table. "Come and sit by me, dear boy, but first go and carve me a slice of venison. A very small slice, mind you. I'm a strict vegetarian." To be fair, the deer had not been killed for food, but had died of an accident, so you could say that her vegetarian principles were being upheld in the spirit, if not the flesh. Miriam owned a herd of rare Pear David's deer, brought back from China by her father, with a view to conserving the species. They are extinct in the wild. One of these deer had unfortunately got itself entangled in a fence and died. Hence the venison on the ethical buffet table. Miriam was once invited to give the prestigious annual Herbert Spencer Lecture in Oxford. The Vice-Chancellor and dignitaries were all seated in the front row of Christopher Wren's magnificent Sheldonian Theatre. They had probably processed in, begowned, mortarboarded up, and heralded by the beadle with his mace, although I don't strictly remember that detail and may have embellished it. Miriam's lecture itself I remember well. It turned out to be a heartfelt plea for animal rights and a passionate denunciation of meat-eating. I was seated immediately behind the Vice-Chancellor and noticed him begin to shift visibly in his seat with anxiety as the lecture progressed. Then I saw a note being passed discreetly along the row, and an aide hustled out, doubtless running hot foot to the college kitchen, where they were busy preparing the post-lecture dinner that the Vice-Chancellor was to host in Miriam's honour. You'd think she might have given his office a warning in advance, but I suspect her sense of mischief took over. On another occasion, Lala had been trying to raise money for Denville Hall, the wonderfully hospitable and sympathetic care home for retired actors, of which she chairs the trustees. At that time, her favourite art form was painting silk with beautiful animal designs. As well as ties, such as the warthog tie which failed to gain the seal of royal approval, she painted truly beautiful silk scarves, all with animal designs. Butterflies, pigeons, chickens, whales, fish, shells, ducks, armadillos. Matt Ridley bought that one for his Texan wife, the armadillo being that state's mascot, and offered them for sale in aid of her favourite charity. Knowing that Miriam habitually wore a headscarf, I encouraged Lala to paint one for this wealthy and philanthropic old lady, in the hope of securing a large donation. The obvious, if unconventional, subject, given Miriam's unmatched expertise in those acrobatic little suckers, was fleas, hugely magnified images of fleas, 9 different species. Lala painted the scarf beautifully, and I sent it off on her behalf, explaining the good cause. Finally, Miriam's reply came. "Please thank your wife and tell her I shall keep the handkerchief." This handkerchief was at least a metre square. "But inform her that she has sadly underestimated the flea penis, which, as you doubtless know, is proportionately among the largest in the animal kingdom." Miriam's letter was accompanied by a generous cheque for Denville Hall and by the gift of her book on flea microanatomy, inscribed for Lala with a note, "See page 112 for vagina of mole flea." less happy television encounters. In addition to the science documentaries of which I have been the presenter, I have on many occasions found myself, one way or another, on the wrong side of a television camera. I won't list them all in detail here. Apart from the only two occasions, which I'll come on to, where I was the victim of deliberately deceitful editing, the series I remember with least affection is The Brain's Trust. The title and format were inherited from a justly famous wartime radio series in which a panel of three people gave off-the-cuff responses to questions sent in by listeners and read out by a chairman. Panelists varied from week to week, but the renowned regulars were Julian Huxley, Commander A.B. Campbell, and C.E.M. Joad. At the time of the original broadcasts, I was a toddler in Africa, but I've listened to recordings, redolent of a bygone era when friends called each other by their surnames and radio voices seemed to declaim rather than converse. "Thank you, Campbell. I say, Huxley, what is your candid opinion?" The television version was never as successful as the radio original. I can't now imagine why I agreed to take part, but for some reason I did. Three episodes, and I hated them all. I was not reassured when the woman in the chair greeted me with an expression of amazement that I was a scientist. She had apparently never met one before. We called them grey men at Oxford, and they used to go to 9 a.m. lectures when we were all still in bed. She followed through by saying, when I mentioned Watson and Crick in one of my answers to a question, "For the benefit of viewers, could you briefly explain who Watson and Crick are?" Would she have made a similar request if I'd spoken of Wordsworth and Coleridge, or Aristotle and Plato, or even Gilbert and Sullivan? Famous name pairings remind me of a nice story told by Francis Crick himself. He introduced Watson to somebody in Cambridge who said, "Watson, but I thought your name was Watson Crick." Cue another digression. I feel privileged to have known both these men. The talents of both were essential to their remarkable achievement in stretching limited data to generate a conclusion of near unlimited significance, and it's not obvious which of the two names should come first in the ubiquitous binary. The opening phrase of Watson's The Double Helix, "I have never seen Francis Crick in a modest mood," doesn't chime with my more limited experience of his senior partner, but it is true that both of them needed huge confidence to pull it off. In my jacket blurb for Crick's autobiography, What Mad Pursuit, I wrote of a justified pride, almost arrogance, on behalf of a discipline, molecular biology, that earned the right to be arrogant by cutting the philosophical claptrap, getting its head down, and in short order solving many of the outstanding problems of life. Francis Crick seems to epitomise the ruthlessly successful science that he did so much to found. He did much more than solve the structure of DNA. His demonstration, with Sidney Brenner and others, that the genetic code had to be a triplet code must be one of the most ingenious experiments ever conceived. Jim Watson, too, if he is arrogant, earned the right to be. His ex-cathedra announcements can be ill-judged, and his sense of humour can occasionally be cruel. But one gets the feeling he doesn't realise it out of a kind of naive innocence. His humour can also be baffling, as when he announced to me that, if he were to be portrayed on film, he wanted the actor to be the tennis player John McEnroe. What could that mean? How are we supposed to respond? But I treasure his answer to something I asked when I interviewed him in the garden of his old Cambridge College, Clare, for a BBC programme about Gregor Mendel, which culminated in the monastery where the great scientist monk did his pioneering work.